You're listening to Vulcan Hello, the Incomparable's only podcast dedicated to new Star Trek. I am Scott McNulty. I am joined, as always, by Jason. Just Jason.
Hi, Scott. Just Scott.
No, of course, Jason Snell. Hello, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We're back with an embarrassment of Star Trek. Remember those when they would do like the season finale of one and then like the and then the premiere of the other? They did that with like Picard and it was like too much Star. It was like this was like this 2 hours of Star Trek today.
Almost too much. It's never too much Star Trek.
No, but it's just a lot. There's a lot of, I mean, then again, I guess when Deep Space Nine and Next Generation were on, there was 2 hours of new Star Trek
every week.
Yeah. So anyway, like the old days is what I'm saying, Scott. Like the old days.
Hey, let's party like it's the early 90s, shall we? Yep. And discuss season 5, the final season of Star Trek Discovery. Everyone's favorite new Star Trek show.
That is not true. Some people's favorite. Other people's not favorite, but that's okay. There's lots of Star Trek out there. Choose your favorite.
There is.
This is how our podcast started, and our podcast is named for the content of the first episode of Discovery. So this is
indeed.
This is how we started this thing. Was
it holds a special place in my heart?
Yeah.
Yes, and I thought, Jason, I don't know if you watched the little previously on at the beginning.
I did.
So we're going to talk about, I should mention, we're going to talk about episode 1 and episode 2.
Yes.
Red Directive is the first episode. Under the Twin Moons is the second episode.
Indeed.
Both of which are available now, Paramount Plus, wherever your Star Trek discoveries are sold in your locale.
Indeed.
In America, at least, you can watch the first episode for free
on YouTube.
So if you're one of those folks, because every Jason and I hear from people who are like, oh, I cancel Paramount Plus. And, you know, binge the Discovery or whatever and then cancel. So if you want to, you know, get a taste for season 5 and see is it worth, you know, ponying up for the next whatever couple months, you can do that for free on the YouTube.
Indeed.
Anyway, so the first episode starts with a little previously on Discovery to catch you up with what happened in season 4 of Star Trek Discovery. And Jason, I don't know if you thought this was interesting as I thought it was as interesting, because that little previously on did not tell you anything about the plot of what happened in season 4, but just focused on the characters and how it impacted the characters, which I think is a perfect kind of synopsis of what Discovery is doing.
Yeah. Yeah. You really just need to know their emotional vector at the moment. Like, are they sad? Are they happy? Did traumatic things happen to them? Are they lonely? Are they in love?
Oh.
These are the things we need to know.
Yes, it's a more of an emotional Star Trek than other Star Trek.
It is. This is the Star Trek that takes time to have emotional conversations
at the strangest times.
It's true.
Continues that tradition, I think. But you know what? Still, I know that there are mixed opinions about Discovery, but I still really like Discovery. And you know why? And even after watching these 2 episodes, I say that as though they're bad episodes, but we'll talk about them. The characters. We've talked about them before, Jason. It's all about the characters. And Star Trek Discovery has a bushel full of good characters.
It does. And, maybe even a new good one, Scott.
Oh, my goodness. That Captain Rayner, you stole my heart with your gruff attitude. Mm-hmm. And you know what I like, Jason? A jerk who is right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I hear you. I thought you were going to say somebody who doesn't care if you like them. And that's why you like them.
That is true. He cares not for your opinion. He just wants to get the job done.
That's right.
He knows his ideals and what he stands for, and he doesn't care what you think of it. But does he? Maybe a little bit. He wants to protect people.
That's true. He's got a heart of gold, but he's got that gruff exterior.
Mm-hmm. And I say, sign me up for that guy.
Yep.
I don't know what that means, but I like him.
Subscribe to his newsletter. Yep.
That's right. And, you know, towards the end of, what was it, the second episode? Yes. Marisa turned to me and said, well, he's going to be her first officer. And spoilers.
Yeah.
Totally.
Literally, I wrote down, we see where this is going. Although, honestly, not to jump ahead, but just to say that there's a moment in is it in the second episode or the end of the first episode? They all run together. But it's the when he's called, like, on the carpet about his exploding of the side of the cliff or whatever. And she says, oh, you know, he just made a mistake. We learn from mistakes. And I thought then, okay.
I see what you're doing here.
What's happening here. But that's okay. Mm-hmm. It's fine because Callum Keith Rennie is a really fun, interesting actor. I've liked him since Battlestar Galactica days. And this character is fun. And he's got like weird pointed ears, but he's not a Vulcan or Romulan. He is a different kind of Star Trek alien. And
from Deep Space Nine. Apparently.
Yeah.
An episode of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. And he's just, but who cares? It's just they give him some alien makeup and he's just a gruff guy. That's his, he's from
a gruff guy.
The planet of the gruff guys.
That's right.
The Gruffalo is from there.
Yes. And, Gruff the McGruff the crime dog.
McGruff the crime dog is from there. Yeah, yeah, that's exactly it. The Gruffalo and McGruff the crime dog and Callum Keith Rennie. That's your planet right there.
That's all you need, and a living room. And just don't have your planet blow up.
No.
Now I completely have no idea what I was going to say. I was going to make a point, but it doesn't matter. That's okay. What are your thoughts on TNG's The Chase? Because I think that episode might have a big impact on this season of Discovery. Not on my card at all.
No. The TNG references here, and there are more of them, more vibes from TNG, but that in particular. So I was in college when The Chase came out, and my memory of The Chase is that I thought it was a fine episode. It really is just sort of a romp, and also an inside joke kind of episode where they explain why all the aliens in our galaxy look like people wearing funny makeup on their faces, because the real reason is it's a TV show and those are all human actors, and that's the best they could do with their budget. But they made an in-universe explanation for it, a little like one of my favorite things that I may have mentioned in this podcast before, where there's a comment about five seasons into Stargate where they point out that the builders of the Stargate network really liked temperate oceanic rainforests. And it was like, and they always built there on every planet that had that. And it was like, it's because they shot that show in Vancouver. And so they just put it, they hung a lantern
on
it.
So
in college, that episode explains it, and I thought it was clever. But my real memory of that is that back in those days, because you're watching Star Trek and it's the 90s and you're in college, you're probably on Rec Arts Star Trek on Usenet, and the most high profile episode reviewer on Rec Arts Star Trek was a guy named Tim Lynch, and he was he's a science teacher now, I think. I read an article that caught up with him, but he was at Caltech and he was a science major or a math major or something like that. And I just remember him being deeply, angrily offended by the episode because, of course, it was basically he viewed it as like anti-evolutionary because it was this kind of hoo-ha about, oh, we didn't originate here, when all the evidence is very clear that all the animals and plants and everything, like, we all have common ancestors, and that's just very clear. And so he was very angry about it, whereas I just thought it was silly because it's Star Trek and don't worry about it too much. And I just remember Tim Lynch's inappropriate levels of anger about that episode that is now, I don't know if Tim still watches Star Trek, but if he does, man, Tim, I'm
really
sorry.
Angry.
They did a whole season of Discovery that's going to be about that episode. Sorry.
I kind of think it's brilliant because The Chase is one of those episodes that you get scattered throughout Star Trek that has this huge kind of monumental discovery. That is not, no pun intended there, much like Saru in episode 2 here. Just tossed aside. Like, nobody cares. Well, who cares that this alien race just created all of life in our quadrant? And it's fine. Whatever. We solved the puzzle. Let's go. So it's one of those dangling threads that I never really thought of. But once I saw it, I was like, oh my goodness, this makes so much sense to follow up on. And it's silly, but I think that you know, Star Trek is a silly show. Let's be honest with ourselves. So, I'm tickled pink that They've got Kovach and the crew being very serious about this very silly thing, based and watching, showing stills from TNG,
right? Holograms from. Mm-hmm. They show Picard. They mention his name. Mm-hmm. It's the second very time nice. Picard's been mentioned in Discovery, which is also hilarious because
he's a big deal.
There's so much here because it's not. I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of all the references.
Jumped to that end, but
and we'll save this for the end. But they have a little this season on Discovery montage that includes one particular image that is bananas.
I think I know what you're talking about. So we'll talk about that.
Yeah, later.
But yeah, I mean, I could not. I mean, that is the thing I wanted to talk to you the most about, like the monumental audacity and inventiveness of, and this is what we get when you get Star Trek fans writing Star Trek.
Yes.
Is they look at the corpus of Star Trek and say, what idea has just kind of been dangled out there that will delight people and people who don't even know anything about it won't care.
This is literally what they did to do Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, though, right? They didn't, and those weren't fans, but they went back and they watched every episode of the original series and took notes about, like, what could we do to follow up on something? And that Space Seed episode, they're like, oh, this guy. Why don't we go back and find out what's happening to that guy? And
he's interesting.
Clearly the Disco writer's room was like, you know, there was one episode where they said, oh, there's this great alien race that created all life in the galaxy. And they had a hologram that said, remember us. And it's not just that, but the fact that that episode was, I mean, it's The Chase. It was kind of a hopping from planet to planet. So it also seems to be kind of the structural inspiration for this season, which is going to be jumping from clue to clue in a sort of galactic scavenger hunt to end up with the answer to this question. Or maybe we'll just learn a lot of lessons and search through our feelings, because it is Discovery in the end.
We're going to do both, yeah. I think. I have to imagine that there was a meeting in the writer's room where they argued about doing The Chase or Conspiracy. And are we going to do The Progenitors or evil insects that are going to take over?
Picard just did the Borg infiltration thing in season 3, so let's not do that. Let's do The Chase. And then somebody in the back of the writer's room was like, can we take everybody to a planet like in the Arsenal of Freedom? Just pile on more Next Generation episodes. And they said, yes, episode 2, you're writing it. Go. And so I guess that was Alan McElroy, the writer of episode 2.
There you go. That's he loves that episode.
Good job, Alan. You're like, you got your Arsenal of Freedom episode in there. So Scott, I've forgotten how we do these. Shouldn't we say how we like these episodes?
Oh yes, we do. I was just so excited to talk about The Chase.
About The Chase.
Which is not my favorite episode of TNG, but kind of a bonkers episode.
Yes.
So it delights me that they have built this whole season around that. But yes, let's get to our own format. So Jason, we've got two episodes.
Yeah.
So you can give me two opinions. Did you like the first episode, Red Directive?
Yes.
And then the second episode, Under the Twin Moon.
I thought they were both good. I think there are very Discovery moments, right? Where you think, shouldn't you be doing something instead of... I like that they're on this chase where they desperately have to follow the Bonnie and Clyde through the galaxy. Mm-hmm. And yet, the end of every episode, they kind of like go back to Starfleet Command and fix their ship for a while and have meaningful thoughts and meaningful talks.
A tribunal.
Like, we'll get back to it, but we... You know, it just is a fascinating thing that the show does, where they build some sort of tension and then just undercut it. But that's what Discovery is. I like it. It's also got perplexing character things, where it's sort of like, are you writing out these characters? Are you, if so, why?
Yeah,
Are you not? If so, why do you make us believe that you are? And there's funny lines, which I really like. Some of the characters get really well used. Some characters are sort of like, the show still doesn't know what to do with them. But I would say is, there are several moments in both episodes that I felt were very Star Trek-y. And I know I've said that on this podcast before, but it is somewhat indefinable. But it's that moment where you say, oh, yeah, that's Star Trek. And like, that is a great moment when that happens. And there are quite a few of those in these two episodes, and so I really enjoyed that. How did you feel about these two episodes?
I am a fan of Discovery. I know I've said this a million times on this podcast that it's trying to do something a little different, and I think that the writers and showrunners have been, I think, perhaps a little disappointed in the reception that they have gotten. And when compared to Strange New Worlds, which seems to be everyone's, like, you know, favorite new Star Trek kid on the block, and Discovery's kind of in the background grimacing a little bit.
Being like, hey, they spun off of us. What's
exactly? Don't forget about us. So I think, and so that being said, I heard, like, there were a million interviews with people involved with Discovery when they're like, season 5 is going to be fun and we're going to make it more adventure-y, and in reaction to, and one assumes, inspired by the love of Strange New Worlds. So then my worry was, will this be just kind of a pale echo of Strange New Worlds and you'll forget the stuff that makes Discovery Discovery? And I think the resounding answer is no. Because they do a lot of Discovery things, but then they also add in some fun, which I appreciate, because Discovery can be, in its previous seasons, a little overly serious really kind of – and I feel like they still pause to talk about their emotions, but I feel like they do it a little quicker, which is good, at least in these first two episodes. So I enjoyed them. I like the whole setup. I like Maul and Locke, which is important to, like, your main bad guys.
Yeah.
But are they bad guys?
Yeah, they're just – they feel like they're agents of chaos more than anything, which I kind of like. And I enjoy that in episode 2, when Book has a conversation with them, he has this, you know, this realization that they really are just a mirror image of him and Burnham. And he's like, oh no, I'm empathizing with our enemies. Yeah.
Yeah, so I like it. My only complaint is that there was no Tig Notaro in this, although her character is referenced. I'm assuming she's going to come back.
It feels like the cast has been – I don't know if it's budget issues or availability issues, but it feels like the cast has been carefully kind of like parceled out. So like David Cronenberg is being his mysterious self in episode 1, and that's fun.
So good.
And then but there's no Admiral Vance. And then in episode 2, we get Admiral Vance, and he actually says the line, Kovic is going to stay behind.
He'll just stay here.
That's basically, oh, he's not in this episode. Like, okay.
Kovic fans, relax. He's not going to show up.
Yeah. And then so Tig Notaro, it's like, oh, no. We'll mention her, but she'll be back next week.
When Saru won't be here for some reason.
Well, that's what I was going to say. We got Tilly back after she inexplicably left the back half of the season last year. I never heard why. Probably there was a reason involving her availability or her doing something else or something. But, like, you're losing one of your great characters. Why? And then here... Again, I don't believe it. I think it's a sham. I think that this is all just a setup, and they're like, oh, and then you say goodbye to Saru. And I'm like, yeah, but...
I'm not saying goodbye to Saru.
Come on. And if they are, what are you doing? Because Saru is one of the great Star Trek characters, not just Discovery characters, great Star Trek characters of all time. So I admit to continuing to be baffled by that, but I assume he's not really going. I mean, he'll have a storyline that will continue. If this is the last we see of him for many weeks, that's real stupid. But again, maybe or maybe Doug Jones had something to do. I don't know. But it, like, I don't want to say goodbye to Saru. I'm not interested in that. Come on, what are you doing?
Saru is great.
So that bugged
me. We at least have to have a wedding episode. So
sure, Vulcan Kelpian wedding.
I don't know what happens in that wedding, but I want to find out.
So we started the show with a Vulcan hello, which is a punch in the face. In this episode, we got the Vulcan proposal, which is just a logic problem, basically.
Exactly. You have to figure out what
it is. Solve it, you get to get married.
Is this a riddle?
Yeah.
Did you ask me to marry you?
With a Vulcan,
it's like a Romulan secret box, which also happens later. Yeah. Also, these two episodes involve Romulans, so you know that I have a soft spot for Romulans.
And we get the classic TNG-era Romulan ship, and they try to dress up one of their sets to look very TNG Romulan-y briefly, and I think they used a bunch of props from Picard season 1, which is fun. And and
Romulans with shoulder pads briefly.
They had the outfit, but not the guy in the hologram didn't have the shoulder. It's like he lost his shoulder pads. They went out of fashion just after TNG, maybe.
I guess that was
a lot of fun to see that. Oh, and we get the what's a holodeck in the 31st century? And the answer is it's the Infinity Room.
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know. I feel like the Infinity Room, which you apparently need a little infinity key to get into. I feel like it's an extra dimensional space. Maybe I'm thinking D&D terms now.
No, maybe it is. Maybe it's like a pocket universe, the Infinity Room.
I feel like it is, but I don't know. That's based on nothing. They don't tell us anything about it other than it's a big white room. And I enjoy the fact that Kovic says, some people call it the Infinity Room. It's a bit theatrical for me, but...
But this, here's this badge with a symbol of Infinity on it.
Here's a lot of theater.
We did branding with it. They ran with it. They ran with the branding of it. The plot is that there's an 800-year-old ship is found, and it's a Romulan science vessel, and it has an item that is of great interest, and the scavengers are going to get it before them, which they do. I noted that in this first adventure scene, we have Burnham's riding on the back of the ship, and then there's tractor beams, and Captain Rayner is like doesn't want to let go, and they're like, but this whole ship is going to blow up if you don't do that. It's fine. The part that I think they struggle with 31st century tech and how to put put people in danger, and the one that got me was when they blew the bottom of the ship out and Burnham was explosively blown out into space, but it's fine because she's wearing her magic belt or whatever that just grows her a complete space suit that she can use to zip around in space. And I thought, I don't know that. And then later she turns a phaser into a rifle in episode 2, and they also blow up their phasers, and then later they just make more. And I thought, what are the rules of this? Can they just they have an infinite number? Can they just get a cannon?
If you keep pulling, it turns into a phaser cannon.
I'd like to know the rules, I guess, is what I'm saying, because it seems like it just is all happening based on whatever the writers want to have happen at a particular moment in time. That part kind of
true. Well, that I agree to a certain point, but I did think it was cool. They're far in the future, so there's a lot of stuff that just can happen. But the problem is, once again, it undermines the tension, though, because Burnham gets blown out of that ship and she calls the Discovery and it's like, oh no, watch out, it's venting, so I'm concerned for the two crew members. But I'm like, why are you concerned for the people who went with you? Because they will also have these suits, so they're fine.
Yeah, everybody's fine. Also, that it was so capable, like I could see she's got a bubble to protect her, right? But it flies around and stuff. It's like fully featured jetpack.
What's her get on a ship that goes into warp, which I did like. And I did like that's really just a reason to get to the scene where she's blown off that ship and then she's flying towards the Discovery and almost hits the view screen, but then they transport her through and then she sits on her chair, which is silly but great.
Yeah,
because great shot. It was fantastic.
That was a lot of fun. And again, it's Star Trek and that was a fun scene. They go to a sand city on a sandy planet. It's got a lot of ATVs.
It's very sandy.
We're going to see them later. And at this point, I said to myself, man, even Star Trek just keeps going to Tatooine now.
When you think of a sci-fi setting, it's either ice or sand nowadays.
Yeah. It's because, that's the criticism of all those Star Wars shows. They keep going back to Tatooine. It's like, no, wait a second. Star Trek Discovery went to Tatooine? What?
The scum and villainy are.
Yeah, right. But this leads to, they're going there because there's a particular dealer of rare antiquities and items named Fred. Previously. And who is it going to be? One of my favorite strange details, again, a reference, an Easter egg, but also just a weird Star Trek detail, which is Fred is a Soong-type android with the yellow eyes and the
I loved it.
What is it? No, He doesn't shorten words. Now I'm blanking.
Oh, no contractions.
No contractions, right? Mm-hmm. Although he does have a different demeanor than Data and a little
very
bit
different.
Of a strange sense of humor, but still also obviously like a Soong-type android named Fred. And I thought that was really hilarious. And he's also a turns out a pronunciation nerd because he rhapsodizes about Maul and Locke's names and then how they
He's
sound.
Delighted by their names.
Yeah, that's very funny. And then he points out that there's a tricorder and self-sealing stem bolts, which is a hilarious reference.
Deep Space Nine reference, yep. Love it.
And a puzzle box. And he's like, oh, I haven't seen one of those in 622 years, which is a very funny moment where you're implying just how old Fred is.
Fred is. Fred's old.
You know, he's probably from the, you know, Picard era or a little bit later, but they refer mm-hmm. to him as a synth later, but we know him as a Soong type android. So he's a latter day Data basically. He solves the puzzle box immediately, which is fun, right? It's a very Data moment. And there's a book inside and he flips through it page by page, which is a very Data kind
Another
of thing
data
to do.
Moment.
Mm-hmm. I like
don't,
all that.
Don't get attached to Fred though.
No, because well, he tries to rob them. He's like, no, I'll give you some Latinum. Get out. And they're like, that's not going to happen. And then, yeah, they shoot Fred. And he may have been alive for 700 years, but he's not anymore.
No. So I enjoy Fred. I enjoyed this scene. My only question, though, is why did Fred not run away? I don't understand why Fred was standing there.
The action was a little mysterious because, first off, you're in Star Trek. And you are in a he's got thugs there. He's got, like, bodyguards. Mm-hmm. And the solution is everybody punches each other. And in fact, they do hang a lantern on it. Fred picks up a phaser and fires it and it doesn't work. And yes. He like taps it like, come on, work.
And Fred, they do say Fred likes he's an antiquities dealer. Yes. Like he likes really old tech. So that's also kind of funny that he picks up this. He has a phaser near him that's really old and it doesn't work.
It doesn't work. But you're right. I found it perplexing that he did not run and that they nobody shoots at each other because it's more fun to have people punching each other, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's the reason, I suppose. But my big problem was, Fred, you should have run, but he doesn't.
That's what gets him killed.
It does. And Marisa was like, I can't believe they killed him. And I was like, well, Fred did try to rob them. So nobody's...
he did.
You know, Fred wasn't great.
Which leads to... a later scene where they're analyzing Fred's body to see if they can, and they actually do extract basically video of everything he's seen so they can see what, because he read the book, they can see the book. Mm-hmm. And the two funny things there, one is Stamets is sad because his great legacy was the spore drive and the Federation has decided not to do the spore drive because
they've got
this pathway drive or whatever. And then immediately they send the Discovery on a mission where they instantly teleport someplace else in the galaxy. And I think, really want to shut down the spore drive thing? Because I don't know, it still seems pretty good. But here he's like, oh, the serial number on this thing is AS whatever. And he's like, oh, it's for Alden Soong. See? All this time later and they still remember his name. And obviously Stamets is mad because they're not going to remember mm-hmm. his name. And he's disappointed. I thought that was very funny. And it's Alden Soong who, of all people to be remembered 700 years later, or 1,000 years later, it's Alden Soong, really?
Yeah, he's not a good one to remember.
And then just the moment where they look down at the body and say, oh, Fred.
I did like that.
So great. So good.
It is legitimately sad. Fred has been alive for a long time, and he dies. It's a sad moment. Yeah. But his name is Fred.
His name is also Fred. He's an android. That's very funny at the same time. Tragic and funny. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Tilly's back, Tilly. Everybody.
Tilly is back and drunk.
Meanwhile, Tilly is, she likes her... whatever champagne
and Andorian champagne, I think.
But here we have a kind of a funny scene where she's hacking into the mainframe. Essentially, it might as well be in a '90s movie. She's hacking into the mainframe,
and immediately Starfleet security shows up and says, "What are you doing?"
Right, but Vance walks in. Right, is it Vance?
Yeah, it's Vance, and he's like,
"Get out of here." I guess he is in episode one then. He's just not in the beginning, but he shows up there. It's just mm-hmm. Kovic who's not in episode two.
Yeah, he's in the beginning because he gets Burnham to talk to Kovic, and then Kovic won't tell him what the red directive thing is.
Move him off and then he comes back around. So he's like, well, it's too bad I didn't get to stop you before you hacked in there and showed us both what the secret of the red directive, which is this thing that's never explained, but I guess it's important. thing.
Top secret.
Top
ultra
secret,
top secret.
Important
double,
thing to
double
do.
Top secret, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. So
and so he basically lets her break into the database so that he can watch the hologram explain the poorly like there are skips in the hologram.
It's a glitchy because that maintains the mystery. The glitchy hologram where he basically says, "Oh, it's so dangerous. There's this ancient power. If anybody were to get a hold of it, but I put it all here in my book, which is the book that we saw Fred take out of the puzzle box." And at that point, like the plot's been advanced enough, it's time for action. We have
some action.
Speeder bike chases in the desert, and they're going to go into they're chasing Maul and Locke, and there's they're going
to
go into
the
tunnels.
Ship.
They're talking to each other on their speeder bikes, and I really enjoy that they do the like split screen that becomes the three screen of them talking to each other. That was a nice little moment, nice little dynamic moment.
And Rainer, and so I also, when Vance sends two captains, two ships to go on this mission, and he tells them, Rainer says, is it my mission or her mission? And Vance is like, eh, just work together.
Work it
and
out.
I thought, oh, that's a bad idea. No. You don't want to have two captains.
No, work it out.
Who have no clear person who's in charge, right? Also, why would you send both your captains down to the planet? But that's a Star Trek tradition, I will not question it.
So the key here, yeah, you got dozens or hundreds of people up in orbit and just the captains go down. So the key here is they're going to get away through these tunnels. And so, but they booby-trapped it behind them. What Rainer wants to do is blow up the explosive that's in the tunnel. And that'll prevent them from going in there. But there's a 30% chance that it will cause an avalanche that will destroy the city that they've been visiting. And he's willing to take the chance because he thinks this is important. And he celebrates when it succeeds because he didn't want it to happen, right? And he's like, aha, 70% for the win. We did it. And then obviously Maul and Locke are like, well, that's an idea. Why don't we just blow up the mountain and kill them all? So I like that because then he's called on the carpet about that later. But also this leads to a moment that is my first, now that is Star Trek kind of moment, which is they are having those debates. I think we need to chase the bad guys. No, we need to save the people on this planet that we basically got killed. As they do the debate it while they're running away from an avalanche
it's
that's
a quick
coming
debate.
Toward them. But that's really fun. Burnham like saves some tourists along the way by having them beamed up to the ship. That was a parent and their child. But like the moment that felt extra Star Trek-y to me is the way they solve it. And I was thinking to myself, they're like, what can we do? And they list a bunch of things that I thought of, right? It was like, can we use the phasers to melt the rock into lava? And they're like, no, it won't stop it in time. And they're like, well, what about this? And then and what about a force field? And they're like, no, we couldn't do it. And then they say the thing that I had also been thinking, which is, what if we just take the two ships down and put our deflectors to full right in front of us and deflect it and stop it? And that's what they do. And it looks great.
It looks very cool.
As they swoop down into the desert, these two starships. And
it just reminds me of Vance telling them, you know, don't make a big fuss of this. Just go in quietly.
Yeah, that does not happen. And then and they plant their saucers in the dirt. And then there's that shot of the avalanche kind of like coming toward them. And then you see that it's actually stopped by the shields. And I was just like, oh, Star Trek. That was just a great bit of Star Trek there. And we've never seen anything, I think, look that good in TV Star Trek before, but also just the whole concept of it. And like, was that something that I had in my imagination? Yes. But then we got to see it. I thought that was a lot of fun. And so they did all of that because they didn't want the people in the city to die. It's great. Love it.
And they didn't. And yes, and that was Rainer, was resistant at first and they needed both ships to do it at the same time and the other ship wouldn't do it. And then he was like, okay, fine. I don't want these people to die.
Yeah.
That's not why we're here.
Yeah. I loved how that looked. And I did immediately think it's going to take forever to get all the sand out of those ships though. And there's a line in the second episode that's like, we're still cleaning the sand out, the radioactive sand.
A lot of sand in there.
Out of the ships, yeah.
And we see a little dot vacuuming up the sand.
Oh, man.
Using a space vacuum.
Yeah.
It's going to take a long time.
It's like, you're never going to get it out. I was, Scott, I had shoes.
It gets everywhere.
Like 8 months later, I had shoes where I'd be like, what is this in my heel? And I would tip it, and it was still sand from Hawaii.
Oh, boy.
So
sand. It's the worst.
It gets everywhere. That's what I hear. That's why you shouldn't mm-hmm. go to Tatooine.
No, Tatooine. There's no real good – no. All you people who live on Tatooine and are listening, sorry, but there's no good reason to go to your
planet.
That's right. We don't want your ears.
Get out.
Go to your moisture farms and do whatever you do there.
See, what else happens in episode one? Saru and Tarina are going to get married.
Get engaged. Hooray. There's going to be a wedding.
And Saru's going to become an ambassador to small planets.
Yes. For some reason.
I don't know. It's like the Tapas of the Federation. Small planets.
Earlier in the episode, he tells Tarina that he's thinking about this, but he wants to consider her and their relationship. And she's like, hey, dude, this is you. You've got to think logically. This is about you, and don't make me influence you, which is a very Vulcan thing to do.
Sure.
And then at the end, when he's like, no, I've decided, you know, Discovery is my family, but so are you, and you're so much more as well. So you have to factor in. And she was like, I was actually hoping that you would do that, but, you know, and you're like, oh, it's a very touching scene. They're a great couple, and I am very happy that they're going to codify their mutual commitment in a more official capacity.
Nice. Classic. We also learn that the dead body, the desiccated dead body of the Romulan that was on that ship, is Dr. Velik. He's the one who has led this trail, and he had the hologram and all that. And they say, hey, he's that one Romulan extra in the background in that episode of The Chase.
And they pinch the zoom at a certain point.
They do. A lot of Vision Pro gestures in this episode, too. A lot of just people making pinches and stuff out in the air.
Those doubters, you see.
I guess it does work out in the end, doesn't it? but I love that. And then Picard, and they get the hologram of the weird kind of like flat-faced...
The progenitors.
Progenitor that they keep showing. And,
Which makes me think that they probably, I'll save it for conspiracy.
Conspiracy. All right. We have a whole other episode before then.
We do. Goodness gracious. And then we find out that from the diary that the place they're trying to go to with the two moons is some planet, Lyric.
Yeah, but, it's a moment of understanding for Burnham, right? Which is that it's not that there are two moons. They're going to be looking for a planet with two moons. It's the twin moons because there are these two synchronized moons. And when we go there in episode two, part of it is like the way it's set up. The synchronized moons do an eclipse, but it's over, I imagine, because the planet is tidally locked or something. It's always over the same area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's X marks the spot, basically. Why not? That's fancy.
Why not?
Fancy.
Who cares?
I mean, honestly, if you lived on a planet that had an eclipse that happened, but only in one place ever, you would build a temple.
That's what
there.
You build the temple. Yes, of course. It makes sense to me. Mm-hmm. So, and that is Red Directive. Because they have to go off and that sets up the season. Let's fly. It's going to be a little galaxy spanning romp and I kind of like, so Discovery has been grappling with these kind of, you know, galactic calamities and these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like the idea that while this is still, they want the scope, so this is a big deal, they're basically chasing two, scavengers who got lucky and are trying to find this thing and beat them in a race to find
the MacGuffin. Yeah.
And so I like that it is pretty simple, even though it's a very powerful MacGuffin. It doesn't seem overly complicated. We'll talk about it in the next episode where everyone seems to know everyone all the time, which is a problematic Discovery thing. But then that leads us to the next episode, Under the Twin Moons, season 5, episode 2.
Well, welcome back to Vulcan. Hello. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jason. I feel like we just spoke about this.
Yeah, it feels like. This episode starts with we got to clean that sand out of the ship.
Yes.
They question Rayner about his decisions in episode one, and my note here is he yells a lot.
My note is before you go, a little testimony.
Yeah.
I know you're busy going finding this huge thing that's super important, but come to our tribunal
We have political problems with this angry man who I like. I mean, I think what Vance says later in the episode is. Rayner is a captain forged in the fires of the Federation being limited and falling apart because of the burn, and that this Federation is trying to become very much like Burnham's Federation. of the past.
Wouldn't it be nice?
And that he is a relic of the past who has not sort of changed his way of thinking. And that's how you get, given the timing of Discovery, you can have a character who's got a lot of experience, but who hasn't, you know, moved with the times. And that's, I think, an interesting take on a Star Trek character. As opposed to like Picard, where we had that great grumpy captain in episode or season three of Picard, and what was his excuse? He's just a jerk. But here, at least Rayner has an excuse.
That's right, and once again, he's a jerk. That's right, generally.
I know we love those jerks who are right.
We love those jerks who are right, and I always enjoy a character who doesn't really act like every other Starfleet character that we meet, and he certainly does not.
Yeah. I mean, again, I mentioned this earlier. Callan Keith Rennie, good actor, really good in this. You know, he is an alien, but we don't really know anything about his alien race. They were in one episode of, what, DS9? So, but like, I really like it because he is right. I mean, the danger of Star Trek is everybody agrees with everybody else. So you want somebody who's going to disagree with you but it's better if they're right. And that's where this episode gets in the end, right? Is that Burnham needs somebody to stand up to her and challenge her. And that's what makes a good number one, or at least for her. And, you know, Rayner is that person where he's got his own opinions and they're going to butt heads. And he's not always going to be right, but he's going to make everybody kind of like do their due diligence and keep them honest. And he'll be grumpy along the way, which is, again, grumpy Star Trek characters are the best, right? All the way back to Dr. McCoy, they're the best.
It's true. It is a archetype that always works in Star Trek. I totally agree. I mean, he's going to, and we even see this in this episode where he, you know, Tilly why am I blanking on the character's name? They're trying to figure out what is running the Adira are trying to figure out what is going on with it, running the probes in on the planet, and he shows up and he's like, I've been monitoring your secure communications, and she's like or they're like, how?
And he's like, red directive.
I can do what I want.
Red directive, all bets are off, all rules are suspended. Red directive, stop saying that. How did you do it? But yeah, he pops in and offers advice and is like very helpful as a hologram,
and I think that's a very useful scene because it shows us his leadership style and how he doesn't know the answer.
Yes.
But he knows how to direct people who do know how to get the answer to focus their energies.
So I think that's a great scene. And I wanted to bring it up because I know we're a little ahead of the plot of episode two, but it's fine. We'll jump around again. It's fine. Mm-hmm. But look, the science in Star Trek, everybody brace yourselves. Is made up.
What?
Science of Star Trek is made up. And you know, so the point is not, sorry to Tim Lynch, the point is not to keep it to like the science of now and to watch them using modern science methods to solve problems. The point of problem-solving scenes is to entertain us by watching characters we know and like, hopefully, work their brains and be creative. And yes, they will come up with a technobabble solution. The technobabble solution can be a fun thing that they discover because it's the thing that ends up having to be put into practice in the next scene. But like the point of it is, when done well, I really love watching smart, clever people thinking and working the problem, right? Let's work the problem, people. And that scene, not only are Tilly and Adira doing it, but then you put in Rayner and he's just like prodding them. He's like, no, I don't know the answer, but let's follow this. And he's like leading them through, not giving him the answer because he doesn't know it, but leading him through the process of thinking creatively about finding a solution. And like, that's all I want from a technobabble problem solving scene is that. Because that's, in the end, that's all that matters is seeing our characters kind of process. And then you add in Rayner, like, guiding them. And it's a great scene. It's, you know, and I know it's technobabble, but it doesn't matter because it's Star Trek. in the end, the point is, and this is very Discovery, that it's Rayner being helpful and like a creative catalyst to allow Tilly, who's brilliant, and Adira, who's brilliant, come up with a good solution to the problem that they're trying to solve, which is in this case, like, what energy could be causing the energy on the planet that's trying to kill two of our favorite characters, right? Like, that's right. That there are stakes, but like all the energy options are going to be made up, right? Like, that's not the point. The point is that he helps them solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And I love that scene. That's one of my favorite things in these episodes.
Yes, that's a great scene. And it also helps, it does what you said, but it also, for the viewer, makes us say, oh, this guy is good at his job.
Yeah.
Because the previous episode, he wasn't, but he's
a bit of a hothead.
But yeah, he was like not doing what Michael Burnham was asking. And we like Michael Burnham and we're kind of like, who's this guy? And so this is like, no, he's a captain for a reason.
Yeah.
And he can deal with people. And he was just focused on that mission, Red Directive. Yes. So he wanted to get it done. And he has different methods, maybe unorthodox methods.
No, right? Because this is the standard meet cute of like, oh, I don't like that guy, and then they're like, but you're gonna like him, and so you make him kind of rough and annoying in episode one. And in episode two, you're like, well, he is annoying, but he does have some positive qualities, and you're like, yep, he's the new number one at the end of the episode.
Surprise!
Okay, I see it now. Right? He was helpful after all. Yes.
He's no Saru, but I still respect him. So,
yeah.
So and you don't want another Saru. That's the thing. That's what Saru says, basically. Like, you don't need me. You need someone like me, maybe, or someone like Book. And I was like, what? You can't make Book first officer. That makes no sense. Luckily, they didn't. I was going to be angry.
That was well done, where it's like, I'm not saying Book. I'm saying that's who you need. That's the kind of person you work with well. And then it leads to Rayner, which is good. But a large portion of this episode is spent where Saru and Burnham take a hike.
Have a very nice conversation.
And they do, because this is, remember, Saru is going to be leaving because he's going he's going to be an ambassador to small planets and get married.
Yes, and I will say again that what I like about Discovery and what I like about Star Trek in general is the characters interacting with each other. And I like Michael Burnham. I like Saru. I like them together talking to one another. I feel like they respect and really admire one another. Yes. Their relationship, you know, shines through as true to me. And so watching them, even though when I'm thinking, well, maybe they should be going a little faster because it seems important, they kind of just lackadaisically hike in this alien planet. But I liked it because I get to watch them talk to each other.
Graveyard planet, too.
It's a graveyard planet.
Graveyard planet. That's all it is.
There's nothing here.
And they have to hike because there's an electromagnetic field that prevents beaming. So they have to hike it.
And I'm sure that will not be a problem.
No, but it does give them the excuse to have their conversations, which is fun.
Yes.
And we discover that Reno gave Saru a nickname, Action Saru. I remember we talked about how there was that episode where Saru kind of goes mad and he can run like 50 miles an hour and is like very dangerous. And we very rarely see that. And when they said Action Saru, I laughed because I thought, well, it's the one who runs really fast. And then later in this episode, Saru runs really fast. Like, Garrett, that's it. That's
they
him.
They had that great scene where Michael's like, okay, I'll go distract, I'll draw the probes away. And Saru's like, no, you're not.
Yeah. Each one of us has you have human reflexes. I have Action Saru reflexes, so I'm going to do that part of it. Yeah, they have a nice, what I wrote down is a nice final season chat. Even though they didn't know it was the final season at the time, feels very final season of Discovery chat. And then there are some dead bodies, and they're like, oh, well, that's not great. And they keep walking. And then there is a giant statue that's fallen apart and ended up in little pieces. So there are pieces of giant body parts everywhere, and including a giant head with four eyes. And Tilly is talking to them and is like, you see anything out of the ordinary? And she's like, no, not really. Which is funny in the moment because there's the giant head of a four-eyed statue. And then the eyes open and drones fly out. And then she's like, take it back. I take it back. This is bad. Yes. And then they're attacked by these drones as they're hiding, and there's that moment where it's sort of like, we're losing our foot, and they're like, what is that? Not our actual
feet.
Foot? We're hiding. It's never mind, right?
It's too much.
I enjoy I enjoy that. And they do the thing where Saru runs and Burnham overloads the phaser batteries, which causes an EMP, which temporarily, right? That's the problem solving temporarily. Yeah. Stops.
It resets the thing so they can get closer. And Marisa, when we saw that face for the first time, Marisa turned to me and said, "Those eyes are going to open because you don't give a statue four eyes and they don't open."
Exactly.
I said, "You're right. They do."
Maybe on like Lost, they would have done it that way. but here, open. Yeah, you know what's going to happen. Saru runs really fast.
He shoots them with his little projectile thingies. There's a moment where you think, oh no, it's not going to work and everyone's going to die, but you know they're not going to.
Yeah, Saru gets shot, but he's fine. It was just a flesh wound, and it makes the light on one half of his uniform flicker.
Flicker, yes, which I thought was a nice touch.
Yeah.
So Book decides that he needs to be useful because he's been put on the ship,
right,
taken away from his refugee work.
That's right.
When he's been kind of like, you know, put on parole for
doing a lot of bad things. Yeah, he's like doing community service.
For doing the horrific things that he did.
Yeah.
He might have gotten off a little bit lightly. But now he's back on the Discovery, and basically because he has been a courier and these people are couriers/scavengers and maybe he knows a bit about them. I wrote down in my notes for episode one, Michael says, "Oh, I know someone who can help." And I wrote down, "She doesn't know many people, so it has to be Book."
Yeah.
And in fact, it is.
And what I wrote down here is Book calls Maul and Locke.
On the dark web.
On the dark web. That's right. Calls him on the dark web. I got this and Samus is like, "What's that?" And he's like, "Oh, it's secret communication tech. I'm going to call him on the it's the dark web. We get it. All right.
We understand."
And so he has a conversation with them, but they're like, "We already know this thing." And he's like, but the Starfleet's going to come after you. And they're like, "Well, if you love Starfleet so much, why don't you marry it? See you later." And like nothing comes of it, but he's shaken.
"Maybe I will."
And it turns out that he says who he is. He says he's Cleveland Booker, and she doesn't really react so much to that. But like afterward, he says, "I recognized her. She is the daughter of my mentor." Because Cleveland Booker is a name that gets handed down. It's like the Dread Pirate Roberts. My mentor, Cleveland Booker IV, that's his daughter. What are the chances? Small galaxy, right?
Very slim chances. This pays off.
Probably not that many people going from planet to planet, star system to star system. Maybe that population is relatively small. I don't know.
It's just I hope this pays off and makes it satisfying. But at the moment, I find it slightly annoying that he knows her.
I want Maul and her boyfriend, I mean, I guess, but like Maul, I would love there to be a dimension to that, right? Where they're not just bad and causing trouble and agents of chaos, but there's more going on and there are twists there. And maybe they are not, maybe they're useful in the end. Maybe they're not the villains in the end.
Because they're not bad. Like they want to get this thing to sell it, basically.
I mean, they're bad, but they're not trying to be destructive. They're in it for the money, like, basically.
They're not super villains.
And for the thrills, right?
Mm-hmm.
As Book quite rightly points out in a thing that I like, he's like, there's a real driving on the edge of the cliff kind of thing going on here. And like, I like that. They're in it for the thrills, for the kicks, and the money. And that's, they're not some evil person with an ulterior motive who's trying to destroy Jean-Luc Picard because it's literally just,
or I need to transport myself to the unicorn and ice cream dimension happily.
Remember that guy? there's a moment where Burnham and Book are talking, they're like, you know, we both have things in our, you know, that have gotten in the way of our relationship. And I thought, okay, well, Book says that his whole planet died, and Burnham's is that Book helped a crazy man try to blow up the most powerful aliens in the galaxy. Similar.
Couples counseling, it will help.
Yeah. So what happens back on the planet, I thought was hilarious. Because look, if we didn't already know that they were doing Raiders of the Lost Ark, and we did, but they find ultraviolet Romulan poems. Saru's vision sees. That's great. It's the clue. Yeah. And they're like, oh.
It's only four stanzas.
And everybody knows that the Romulan poetry has five stanzas. If they know
where
poetry.
Where could the fifth stanza be?
And this is the thing. Maul and Locke, not poetry aficionados. And that is their downfall.
And they are not steeped in Romulan lore from 800 years ago.
Exactly. So, well, I imagine classical Romulan poetry. Maybe, you know, maybe Saru's girlfriend has been reading Romulan poetry to him.
Oh, maybe. So, well, and like, Burnham seems to know about where the Romulans put their real doors on their houses and things. So.
Yeah, well, I guess so. I mean, she might have brushed up on that with N'Var, or maybe they know that because of being, she was in Vulcan. I don't know. But yeah, there's a lot of Romulan lore here going on. But it leads them to move this big statue thing that's got the writing on it. Mm-hmm. And there's the last verse is underneath it, along with like an object that's hidden down there. And this made me laugh so much because it's literally the scene from Raiders of the Lost Ark where they say, oh, you know, build the staff this tall. And they're like, oh, great. And they're like, no. And we turn it around to the other side and it says, and then make it a little shorter to honor the Hebrew God. And they realize that the bad guy only had the one side of the amulet burned into his skin. And they look at each other and say, they're digging in the wrong place. And guess what?
They're going to Beta Zed. That's not where you want to go.
Maul and Locke are digging in the wrong place. It is literally Raiders of the Lost Ark happening here. And then a giant statue wakes up that's fully in one piece and is about to fire phasers out of all four of its eyes. And then they beam up.
They leave. And they're going to go to Trill. They figure it out very quickly. Because Romulans love secrets and riddles, which I think is fine.
So our other character who left last season, Gray is on Trill. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be like, oh, we get to see Gray on Trill. I do feel like the show has kind of forgotten that Adira is a Trill. She's a human Trill, which is like the first time that that's happened. She's a very rare thing. And yet we always just treat her like one person, but she is a symbiote who's got she is part of a symbiont system, and she's got an ancient, or they, it's a they. They have this Trill symbiont relationship thing. And I feel like the show has decided, let's not get into that. So I'm just saying, that's fine. I get it's complicated. One of your characters has like a bug and they're a complex being that is, they are a young person and also a complex old bug.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're going to Trill next week, we got to deal with this. Like, you got to
deal with it at Trill.
You got to deal with it a little bit because, like, why is this character a bonded Trill if they're they never have it come up in conversation, right? So I would like to see Adira get the chance to deal with their Trillness.
I assume they will go to the underground pools on Trill where the symbiotes are maintained by the acolytes, and a wise acolyte will tell them something.
Yes, having seen the scene from next week on the Ready Room, yes.
Oh, well, see, there you go. I didn't see that scene, but
assumed. Of course, you're going to Trill. You know, very that's rarely does Star Trek go to Trill and say, you know, we're just going to the soccer stadium.
Let's go to the 7-Eleven. It's fine.
Yeah. You go to the pools. That's what you do if you go there.
My question, though, Jason, is they're going to Trill. Trill is an entire planet.
Yes.
I don't know where on Trill they're going, so we'll find out next episode.
But they do. They're going to the pools, right?
Oh, well, I guess they're just going to go to the pools and ask one of them, hey, was a Romulan here about 800 years ago?
According to the scene I saw, and that's not far off. Okay, but we'll see what it actually is. It was just one little scene, so we'll see.
But
clearly the whole structure of this season is, and I was going to mention this Romulan, like, he really seems to enjoy, like, aha, and then I'll leave a clue here, and then I'll leave another clue here, and only
this
the strike most
me
dedicated.
As a Romulan thing to do, though.
It seems like a lot, but it means it's fun, right? Because it means that they're going to be following from clue to clue and planet to planet.
Well, you know, Kovic talked about how the Infinity Room is very theatrical. I feel like the Romulans and the Vulcans are both very,
very
theatrical
people. That's how they can express their feelings in a way that is more acceptable.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it makes this season episodic in a way that I think that they did want to kind of take a page from Strange New Worlds and make it feel a little like the episodes don't totally blur together. Like, there's the episode on the sand planet in episode 1. Episode 2 is the hiking mausoleum planet with the murderous statues with drones. Like, there's some clarity, and so episode 3 will presumably be Trill. That's fine. That's good. That's good.
Yeah, I think clarity. It's great. I think it's a very clever structure for the season. So I'm looking forward to seeing more. Yeah. But hopefully we will see more of Saru. Although here at the end, Saru's packing up his quarters. So apparently, I was thinking, well, who's going to move into those quarters?
Yeah, I know, right?
Because it's going to need a lot of scrubbing. Mm-hmm. But apparently, they're just going to keep it that way forever. Yeah. So
I thought basically this is going to be the botany lab, right? We can't use this for anybody else's quarters, so we're going to turn it into the Saru botany lab.
The Saru Memorial Botany Lab.
Exactly. And anybody who wants to sleep in the botany lab, there's a bed. But really, it's just the botany lab.
And you know, that's a quibble. The scene is very nice where Michael and Saru are saying goodbye. And he's made his decision. He's going to be the ambassador. And so he's packing up his, you know, his whatever that thing is.
Yeah, not his plans. Backpack. Yeah.
Not his plans. He's leaving them there. But everything else is coming home with him. Right, or he's not
knife.
Going home.
He
took his knife and whatever, his backpack, and he's off. And then very quickly, Michael talks to Admiral Vance, and he says, "I read your report. Good job. I'm learning geometry, FYI." And he says, "Oh, I asked Rayner to retire, early retirement, because, you know, political thing, it's a mess. I don't want to upset the president. He can retire." And so off she goes. She needs a first officer, and she has been talking to Saru about what qualities of first officer she would need. And so she has people on the ship that she could choose, but she has identified Rayner as the perfect candidate. And they have a very good scene where he is kind of like, "Are you sure?" And she's like, "Eh." And then it ends with him zipping up his uniform and nodding, and there we go.
So let me tell you, this was another one of those moments where I'm like, oh, that's Star Trek, right? Like
it's good.
It's people in red jackets talking sort of about their feelings and about duty and who they are as people and how they define themselves. And that she shows confidence in him. I mean, he's older and has all this history as a captain, but he's been laid low by his own actions and by politics, and she's giving him a lifeline and he tries to bat it away, and she says, "No, I'm serious about this." And he's like, "I won't be a yes man." She's like, "That's what I'm counting on." and then he has that moment where he zips up his jacket, and I'm like, that's the stuff right there. Like, that is in that Star Trek II, we're talking about mortality and our feelings and what we're going to do with the rest of our lives and all that. It's that kind of stuff where it's like, it's the human drama inside Star Trek. I love it. I love it.
And Michael Burnham is a very complicated character herself. So she has been in a very similar situation that he has. And she even says, "I was given a second chance, and so I think you deserve the same thing."
By an evil mirror universe guy. I'm not that.
No, I'm not from the mirror universe. Look, it's bright in here. It's fine.
And he did it sort of because he was in love with my mirror version of myself, and it was creepy. But we didn't know that at the time. The point is, I got a second chance. And Saru, as her nice conversation with Saru, that Saru gave her a second chance. The one thing, in fact, that I wish we had gotten, and I think maybe it's not in there because some viewers might have been confused by it because it was so long ago, is I feel like the unspoken thing between Saru and Burnham is that they both loved Captain Giorgio.
Oh, yes.
And Burnham's responsible for her dying, kind of.
Yeah,
like, not directly. She didn't kill her, but like, she got them into trouble, and that got Giorgio killed. And I every now and then I think they should mention Giorgio, not the Emperor and all of that, but they should be like, I kind of wanted a moment where Saru said, "Captain Giorgio would have been proud of you," right? I kind of wanted something like that in there, because that is, because that was the stone in the shoe of their relationship for a long time, was that she you know, betrayed Captain Giorgio in episode one, and it got her, you know, killed, and got Burnham charged and convicted of mutiny, and set her down that path where then she gets on Discovery and Saru is there and is like, "I'm watching you. You're bad.
I don't trust you."
And they've come a long way, which is really great. But yeah,
it's great. I mean, I think it's and the you know, Seven having chances. Talked about these two episodes, I like them even more than I did before. Of course,
that's
we're talking
we
about
this,
the best
Scott.
Parts of them. But yes, sometimes it has the opposite effect. It, but
yeah,
this time,
it's not why we do it. But sometimes it happens. it happens. No, this is very Discovery. Look, I understand why Discovery is not everybody's cup of tea. I've definitely had problems with some of their plotting and their back plotting to get characters or get this plot where they want it, even if things don't make sense. And I don't like the book's planet was a living room with a TV and four people. But what Discovery does get is the aspect of, you know, relationships and feelings and belief in the Federation as a beacon of values and a model for people in the galaxy and like all of these things that are idealism and feelings and connection with each other and infinite diversity and in
infinite combinations.
And all of these sort of Star Trek-y things, which are all have always been there, but are only part of the total palette. And that is what Disco has always kind of leaned into. And I think that it does. I think these two episodes do a very good job of saying, yeah, that's what the show is going to be. And there's fun action stuff and some funny stuff and all of that. But like in the end, that's, and I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but like it is very Star Trek-y in very specific kinds of ways. And that was on display in these two episodes. So I'm hoping we'll have an enjoyable final eight from here.
Yes, I agree. And one of my things that I like most about Discovery is they really lean on the fact that people can believe in the same mission, but have different opinions about how to do that and have the same kind of core beliefs, but still have disagreements about how you get there. And really lean into the fact that the Federation is an idealist organization that doesn't always meet its own ideals.
Yes.
And so that's that. And I know some people get bothered by that idea, but I feel like that's a very kind of humanizing way to think about it. Because nothing, if you know, I will mention the first season of TNG was not super interesting because there was no conflict and everything was perfect.
The
and,
point is,
you know,
we strive to be better and live up to our ideals. It's really boring and unrealistic to say, well, we have ideals and we always meet them and we're great, right? It's more like the ideals are not there to define who we are. They are there to define who we want to be, right? And that's not always easy to live up to them, but that's why you have them, is because then you are forced to live up to them. And that's a thing that Disco has always been about. And I appreciate, and that is, like I said, very Star Trek-y. It's not the only way to think of Star Trek, but it is definitely one of the ways to do it.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to the rest of season five and sad that it is the last season, but hopefully it will be satisfying. But now we should fire off the phasers and enter into the conspiracy corner.
Oh, yes.
We'll move this Gorn skeleton out of the way.
That's right.
Roll
it back.
I didn't even mention.
Get in there.
Lieutenant Commander Trill. Lieutenant Commander Tribble makes
room.
That's right. Oh, that's right.
Or
take
is it
out
just
your
a holodeck
emblem.
In Kovic's quarters? I don't know.
Nobody knows, but we are now in a big white room, Jason,
yeah,
where
that's right.
We may speak freely of things. Now, you mentioned a scene in the coming up this season, and I'm assuming it's the same scene, but I'll let you talk about it.
Yeah, so in the coming up in this season of Discovery, one of the shots, it's very quick, is a Constitution-class starship emerging from some sort of glowing something, which, you know, is there going to be a Strange New Worlds crossover, maybe?
How can there not be
that? And somebody else, a very, very knowledgeable and smart person, pointed out to me that there's a brief sort of like phaser fight also shown in that montage that seems to be very clearly on the sick bay set of Strange New Worlds. So both shows shoot in Toronto, and so they've got there. So it could be, is it an actual like crossover with Strange New Worlds where the Enterprise is pulled to the future and then they have to send him back, but they get to like say their goodbyes and all of that? Or is that kind of a, you know, they showed us only what they want us to see, and that the truth is that it's, you know, some other, I was joking, it's like, oh, but it's actually the USS Excalibur and it's nobody you've ever seen before and whatever. But but anyway, it's just a moment where you know that silhouette. It's mm-hmm. if it's not the Enterprise, it is a Constitution class TOS Enterprise of some sort or other. So that part was the part where I went, I mean, I've already gotten a Soong android, the Chase from TNG.
What more could you get?
Like, I get the feeling like they're gonna pull out, and that makes it Star Trek-y too. Like Callum Keith Rennie doesn't have to be an alien from a planet that was like we saw an alien from that planet in an episode of Deep Space Nine in the 90s, but it's fun that it is, and it's fun that the Necropolis planet they're on is of an alien, a dead alien race that appeared in, I think it was Booby Trap, the TNG episode. So like, it's a bunch of like, you don't need to know it. It's fine, but it's kind of fun that it's there. But then you bring the Enterprise into it, and that's even more. So I think they're going to be surprises, great and small.
I think you're right. And there are reports that I gasped at that moment in the season thing, because I was like, oh, it is the Enterprise. What is going to happen? Mm. What is happening? Mm-hmm. I'm very excited about what season 5 holds for us.
Yeah. Any other conspiracy theories, or is that it?
Well, there was a Tribble, and I think the first episode just kind of chilling around. So I assume he is a decorated officer, and he's working on Discovery.
Officer Tribble. Well, yeah, the Tribble was like moving, like going up on an archer or beam or something. Just
he was just kind of walking around, I don't know what
they. I mean, whatever it is, pregnant, there's a Tribble. is that Ensign Tribble? I don't know.
I assume it's Ensign Tribble. Who knows in the future? But I'm just excited to see more Tribbles, basically.
Maybe. Yeah. And given that there was only one, it makes me wonder if maybe they solved the Tribble reproduction issue.
They might have.
They got birth control for Tribbles now.
or they neuter them? I guess that's not kind. Don't neuter your Tribbles. Or do neuter your Tribbles? I don't really know where we stand on neutering. I guess you should neuter
Tribbles. Yeah, no, it's good. It's humane.
Right. Otherwise, your ship.
Have your Tribble spayed and neutered.
Your ship explodes and it's horrible.
It's very bad. Yeah, don't do that. Don't do that. So that's your conspiracy corner, is that we're going to gradually see more and more Tribbles on the Discovery until they have to blow it up at the end.